Hello everyone, this is Gabriel Greshler, and I am your host for this month's February Student Press Law Center podcast in honor of Black History Month. On this month's episode, we're honored to have with us Richard Dick Prince. Prince was a member of the Metro 7, a group of journalists at the Washington Post in the 1970s who fought for equal representation in the newsroom. Today, Prince continues to write about race and news media in his column, Journalisms. Prince is also the recipient of the Ida B. Wells Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. He was described as the journalist's journalist by Washington's Capitol Press Club. We invited him to the Student Press Law Center to discuss his origins as a reporter, going up against the Washington Post, and why newsrooms need to become more diverse. And so, were you interested in journalism early on? Was it something that you were like, I really love this? Or yes. Did it take time to kind of
even as a little kid, I had a mock-up newspaper that I used called the Belltown News, because there was a bus, a toy bus called Belltown. I think Belltown was the destination, so I called it the Belltown News. And then I remember when I was in about eighth grade, the teacher let me put little news notes on the board. So I guess I was sort of hooked early without even realizing it.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. What was your first sort of like experience writing a story? Did you join your high school newspaper? Did you join your college newspaper?
Yes, I was on the high school newspaper, and okay. I was on the college newspaper. And then I went out into the quote-unquote real world, where it was right after the riots of the 60s, right during the riots of the 60s, where I was at the Star Ledger in Newark, and Newark had a riot in 1967, which was one of the earlier ones. And I was working at the Star Ledger on the weekends and over the summer. And sure enough, so I got sent out there to go to the hospital, and as they were bringing in people. And it was a little frightening, you know, driving down the streets when you didn't know what was going to happen, who was throwing bombs, Molotov cocktails, or whatever, down at the cars, you know, and it was dangerous to have the word press or the newspaper's name or the television station's name on the side of the car, so they didn't do that.
Okay.
and the media were not very, the mainstream media were not very well liked or respected, you know, in the Black community at that time. And there are a lot of similarities now. Because she hears some of the same sort of comments. That was sort of how it started.
At what point did then you go to the Washington Post mm-hmm. and the Metro? It was originally 9, correct?
Yeah, right.
Tell me about kind of the evolution of that story and lead me through it.
Well, I joined the Washington Post in 1968, which was the same year I graduated. And it was right after they had a riot here in Washington, D.C., which was after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Demonstrators resisted when police attempted to arrest a young man who tried to rip down an American flag. The police fired tear gas canisters. The demonstrators threw them back at the police.
And so we came down, and they were, the Washington Post was one of the more progressive newspapers in terms of hiring people of color at that time. But by 1972, they had a sort of a critical mass of people, of Black reporters, who said, well, you know, they're not doing enough, and we're not getting the assignments we should be getting, and there are not enough people being hired into key positions. And, you know, one person would say this, and say, yeah, I noticed that too. And so the group of us, I think 9 of us who were on the local staff, the Metro staff, got together, and we asked the management a group of questions. So why is this the case? Why is this the case? Why is this the case? And that began a back and forth between us. Now, the difference between just, you know, a bunch of reporters just griping or whatever, and this was that we had a lawyer, and the lawyer was Clifford Alexander, who had been Secretary of the Army and also had been chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So he knew about affirmative action and setting of goals and timetables and all that. I think the management wanted us to just, you know, vent, and then they would, you know, do whatever they do. But no, we weren't there to vent. We were there for specific reasons, and that was to get answers to these questions and to get some commitments that there would be some changes made. And so that went on for about a month or so until we didn't get any commitment for goals and timetables. And so we said, all right, well, we'll just leave it at that. And then we filed our complaint with the EEOC. And they found that we had grounds to proceed, but we would have had to have gone to court, and that would have been more expensive than, you know, we could afford at the time. So we just left there.
Okay.
Meanwhile, management did make some changes, and they made some hires. People who had been on a waiting list all of a sudden were hired, for example. And it prompted other people at other newspapers and other media organizations, not just newspapers, to go ahead and challenge their own managements, so that you found actions taking place with the New York Times, Associated Press, these other places.
Sort of a domino effect
started. Yeah. People saw that. And it wasn't just the people of color, because I have to include some Hispanics in this too. But then women noticed, and then they started getting together, and they've got together at the Washington Post and Newsweek and these other places. And that movement actually is still going on, as is ours, but particularly with women now, with the whole Me Too movement, you know, that's going on in media and other places. So it had that effect of inspiring other people, as well as creating some change at the Washington Post.
Now, so something I was thinking about sort of when I heard this story, was that usually, and as we were kind of talking about before with student censorship, usually it's, you know, in our case, it's students going up against their administration. But in your case, you were sort of going up against your own workplace, you know?
Right.
And I'm wondering what it sort of felt like to be kind of critiquing the hiring practice of your own newsroom, and you're working there at the same time,
yeah.
You know?
Well, that still goes on. People are still doing that. We had to... it was a matter of convictions, and I think that the Washington Post, being a quote liberal newspaper, subscribed to our convictions. They just thought that we were too demanding, I guess. And, you know, they agreed that, you know, there should be equity and all that. And there was a feeling on our part, you know, we're all young and single. It was an important part of this, that we could lose our jobs. But because we didn't, you know, we didn't have family obligations and all that to tie us down, we could feel, have a little more freedom to pursue what we thought needed to be done.
So the American Society of News Editors created a series of benchmarks in 1978, saying by 2000 they wanted to have newsrooms to accurately reflect the population of people of color. This didn't happen, and the number stands at 16% today. So why have we not made more progress?
Well, there have been a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Number one, I don't think that the will has been there to do that. And then number two, there have been some interruptions. For example, when the internet came into being, it sort of monopolized everybody's attention, because it took away the advertising revenue, and they had to worry about the bottom line much more than they did had previously.
Okay, so it kind of became like they didn't prioritize it.
Okay. Without realizing that if you're going to think about the future, you have to think about who's going to be in your audience. And at the same time that was going on, the demographics of the country were changing. And so if they wanted to reach the new audiences, they really did need to have some more diversity there. But they weren't thinking that way. So that's another reason why there hasn't been more progress. But I think it's really a lack of will. And I use as an example the Gannett Company, which owns USA Today and 91 other newspapers around the country. Was a leader at that time in diversity. Mm. Knight Ritter was also, which went out of business, but they owned the Miami Herald and the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Detroit Free Press and some others. The Gannett Company was led by a guy named Al Newhorth, who was kind of an extravagant guy.
Staffing USA Today from scratch offered a unique opportunity to prove that a diverse workforce could indeed be built and that it would work just fine.
But he believed strongly in diversity because he was raised by his mom and watched her be discriminated against as a woman and vowed to, you know, that shouldn't happen to other people. So at the Gannett Company, there was a full-throated effort on diversity. And one of the components of that was that when you had your evaluation, if you were a manager, your progress on diversity was part of that. Mm-hmm. So it was tied to your salary, basically. So that's a powerful incentive. But Gannett was very serious about that. And as a matter of fact, when USA Today was founded, I wrote about this on their anniversary, the editor who just died, the founding editor just died last year, John Quinn, explained that they had a higher percentage of journalists of color at USA Today than any other newspaper, and also than the percentage in the general population, which is a stark contrast to what the industry was doing. Mm. And they laid down some guidelines, such as when USA Today was founded, the front page above the fold had to have a photograph of a person of color or a woman every day.
Wow. This was back in the 80s.
Right, yeah. And some people said, wow, isn't that political correctness, blah, blah, blah. There was some grumbling in other places, but they said, this is the way it's going to be. And as a result of that happening on the front page, the leaders of the section fronts, sports and life and the other ones, money, they all did the same thing.
I want to bring up a quote from The Atlantic. So a writer named Ed Yong, so he wrote in February this month about trying to include more women in his writing. And he, you know, looked back and saw that, you know, I think it was less than 20% of his writing he would source women. And he says in the article, so he sort of talks about people that criticize him for trying to include more women. And
really?
He says, quote, "Skeptics might argue that I needn't bother, as my work was just reflecting the present state of science. But I don't buy that journalism should act simply as society's mirror. Yes, it tells us about the world as it is, but it also pushes us toward a world that could be."
That's true.
End quote. So my question for you is, you know, what role should journalism have discussing a world that should be, and how should this sort of mentality be applied to seeking more people of color?
There are editorial pages and there are news pages in newspapers. They have that distinction. Mm. Editorial pages are also where it probably have more of a clear field to portray the world and advocate for the world as they think it should be. And I like to follow what the editorial pages are saying about some of these issues. And I think there's a lot of the bold ones get recognized throughout history. For example, the ones in the South who were for integration while, you know, segregation was going on. So the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, for example, was known as, you know, being bold and courageous and fighting for that. Today, I think there is more of people are the editorial pages are advocating for some of the right things, but they also are closer to, you know, their ear to the ground, and they won't go that much farther than the rest of the readers are, you know. But some of them are doing some interesting things. For example, the one of the issues that I was following was all the Confederate monuments around the South and the efforts to take them down. And the Dallas Morning News suggested that they wanted their readers to contribute examples of local people who are not recognized, you know, women and people of color who should have statues, you know, and have contributed to the Dallas area. So that was something that was different. In Richmond, which was the capital of the Confederacy, they have these huge statues on Monument Avenue of all these Confederate generals. It's a tourist attraction. When Reverend Wyatt T. Walker died, and he was an aide to Martin Luther King, and it was from that area, the Virginia area, the Times-Dispatch suggested that a statue of him be placed on that avenue, which would have been, you know, which would, I don't know whether it would go anywhere, that idea would go anywhere, but it would certainly break up that whole, you know, homage to the Confederacy on that street.
Going actually to right now, obviously in Parkland, Florida, really sad, terrible incident that happened there. But at the same time, there are some students who actually are journalists as well. Some of them in the group are high school journalists. Who are sort of fighting back against the NRA, against certain politicians within the state.
Stoneman Douglas survivor and student journalist David Hogg is here with me now. David, first of all, we're so happy that you are here and that you're alive and well. Thank you very much for stopping by.
No problem. I just want people to hear that this is unacceptable, and we can't let this continue happening. We've seen far too many.
So I'm sort of wondering, you know, taking the lessons that you learned being one of the members of the Metro 7, what advice would you give these kids? And I know it's two different situations, but you know, you both were trying, or are trying still, to solve a really difficult issue. So what sort of advice would you give to these students, considering also that they are journalists as well, and they could use that power?
Well, I think that be a good journalist, and that is marshal all the facts that people need to know. Of course, people will make their own decisions, but they need facts to help them make it, and that's your job. Your job really isn't to be advocating for this, that, or the other, but to provide, to report on what's going on and to provide people with the information they need so that they can make the decision that's right for them. So just try to be the best journalist you can be.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Student Press Law Center's podcast. Also, thank you to Richard Dick Prince for the interview. Be sure to visit Richard's website, journal-isms.com and theroot.com, to view more of his writing. News clips by ABC News, C-SPAN, and the National Press Foundation. Music by freesounds.org. We'll see you next time.